on the Empire Podcast this week, Ewan McGregor has the higher ground as he pops by to talk Our Kind of Trader, while the director of Everybody Wants Some also talks to us. And I'll finish that link later. All that and more in a movie podcast that is thinking of suing Radiohead for copyright infringement. Those lovable bleeper bloopers. They've just taken what we do in the Empire Podcast and put it out as an album. That's outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is Burnley's favourite son, if you don't count the Burnley FC football team that recently won the championship, and Sir Ian McKellen. It's Johnny Pyle.
Hello, mate.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent.
I'm delighted to be first. I'm never first when you introduce people.
I like to mix it up.
Yeah, I wasn't ready. I was like, Burnley's favourite son, and then looking over at Helen saying, sounds like a me.
Yeah, and looking around going, well, you're not from Burnley, Chris, and you wouldn't be introducing yourself. And Helen's not a son either.
No.
Yeah, you're
true.
Not.
I'm not.
Yeah, okay.
Although I'm known for my sunny disposition.
You are.
Where?
You are.
Well, elsewhere.
Okay.
I think we've ruined the next introduction. Like, we all know who it is now. Next up is Port Stewart's favourite daughter, if you don't count Brianna Corrigan from the beautiful south.
Brianna. She has to be my babysitter.
Sorry, I'll correct that then. If you don't count Brianna. That's a strange way to pronounce Corrigan, don't you think? But there you go. From the beautiful south. And I didn't know this.
Yeah.
Jensen Ackles and Jared Padalecki, who are temporarily from Port Stewart while they are living in a basement under your house. Isn't that correct?
That's not
Helen
true.
Helen O'Hara. Yes, it's so true.
That's not true.
It's so true. Legally, I must say that that's absolutely not true. The life model decoys that are currently starring in Supernatural.
They're life model decoys.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. All right, welcome both. We have a question.
Bring it.
I'm bringing it. The question has been... This has been delayed now from two podcasts in a row, but it's such a good question that I wanted to include it at some point. So here it goes. It's from Ankit Mathur, and apologies, Ankit, for delaying your question. He says, "Hey guys, loving the podcast. It's a good start.
Hi.
Good start. Question for your bulbous brains: are you sure you listen to the podcast? What are the best light bulb moments in the movies? Like when a character has a story changing realization, like Keanu Reeves and the wildcat moment in Speed, or the ticket to Venezuela moment in Spanish Prisoner, or that moment in The Usual Suspects?" Well, thanks for using up all the examples I was going to use.
Yeah, because the right answer is The Usual Suspects, probably. Like, that's the best one, I think.
Is it the best one? Oh, Johnny's making a face
like he disagrees.
Well, I mean, I want to go first on this one because I'm worried that everyone will say the same thing as me, which is the multiple light bulb moments from National Treasure. Sort of when he's looking at the Declaration of Independence, he's like, I've got to steal the Declaration of Independence, and off they go and steal it, and it's wonderful. And then
it wonderful?
And then later,
it's truly wonderful.
And then later in the movie, which is I think it's less famous, but you know when they're in the clothes store getting new clothes, and he's paid with a number of $100 bills,
uh-huh.
And they realise that the secret to the next clue is on the $100 bill they just paid with.
Wow. Oh, it's all, it is wow.
That's not the light bulb moment, though,
it's
people.
It's all about the Benjamins, though. That's amazing.
And then they get a $100 bill back and check the time, and they're like, oh, we've missed it by about 40 minutes. And then Riley, Justin Bartha, he's like, wait, no, we didn't miss it. And he knows something about history that Benjamin Gates doesn't know, which is that daylight savings time was introduced in World War I. And that actually, they've got 40 minutes to get to the place to find the next clue.
So the hour is 80 minutes long?
What?
You said they missed it by 40 minutes and they've still got 40 minutes, so that seems like...
20 it. Some minutes? I think they missed it by 20 minutes and then they've got 40 minutes to get to the place.
Okay, cool.
But his light bulb moment is the moment because it's such a clever play on the fact that Ben knows everything and now...
And
Riley knows everything.
I can't believe you remembered two character names from that film. I'm so impressed. Stephanie Seelan, formerly of this parish,
yeah,
used to get genuinely outraged by that film because of the number of times they say the phrase Declaration of Independence. Mm. It is actually one of the better movie drinking games. If you take a drink every time someone in National Treasure says Declaration of Independence, you'll be stocious in no time.
I mean, it's hard to make that movie stocious. Any better, but I think with alcohol, probably, well, actually, not for
no,
you
pretty,
two.
Pretty definitely, yeah.
But, wow. So yeah, I mean... I think maybe I just love Justin Bartha realisation moments because I really love the moment at the end of The Hangover as well when they realise where Justin Bartha is and then Stu tackles Bradley Cooper, right?
That's right,
character names, so that's another great one. Any more Justin Bartha lightbulb moments you can think of?
I mean, so many that I can think of. I just can't choose one.
Yeah, he. Yeah, I wonder what he's like when he turns on a light bulb. He must be. What is this thing? I think Johnny's nailed it. I think that's the right answer.
Yeah,
I've just looked it up on the internet, and yeah, that's it. That is the right answer.
So Steph Steele doesn't like National Treasure.
No, she likes it. She just hated the number of times. She just hated the number of times they said Declaration of Independence.
I mean, well, it doesn't have another name. You can't call it something else.
I know, but like they say the full phrase Declaration of Independence like a bajillion times, and it just really got to her. And now I've pointed out to you, next time you see it, you're going to see how many times.
Well, I don't watch it. Actually, I do want to watch it.
Yeah,
today.
You do.
I love that movie. I genuinely love it.
I mean, you know, if it's a Saturday night and the remote control is like way over there, I will watch it.
I just recently chucked out loads and loads of DVDs and Blu-rays because I was like, they're just taking up too much space. But I kept both National Treasure films.
Both? Gosh.
Well,
wow.
Well, when they finally make the third, which they promised at the end of Book of Secrets, because the president, and you don't say no to the president, he comes over and says, "I've got another thing for you."
Mm. Ah,
what's that thing?
Then. What is it?
What could it possibly have? Yeah, I want to see more of Benjamin Franklin Gates. Who doesn't?
Who indeed?
Who doesn't? And Harvey Keitel is we because that movie might rescue Harvey Keitel from his Direct Line TV ad nightmare.
And indeed, it could rescue Nicolas Cage from his choices.
What do you mean his choices?
Oh, come on.
I don't know whether he has much of a choice these days, doesn't he? Because he has to make loads of movies because of, you know, off-screen financial things that went on in his life. So, poor guy, pretty much, we could probably make an Empire podcast movie. If you offered him 50 quid, he'd have to do it.
Well, there's an idea.
Phil Desemlian can't be here today. Because he's expecting a delivery, apparently, of some hot new subtitles. So he couldn't be here. He was meant to be here. And he texted me what he thinks is the right answer to this question, which is the original Taken in Pelham 123, the very, very end, when Walter Matthau goes to the home of Martin Balsam, who is one of the criminals, the only one to escape and get away with it. And earlier in the film, the criminal sneezed. And he's given nothing away to Walter Matthau, and so Walter leaves the flat, and then Martin Balsam sneezes, and the film ends with Matthau going, "Get on tight," and opening the door and going, "Basically, I've got you, pal. You are screwed." So there we go.
So that's Phil's.
That's Phil's.
I thought
what's
of a couple.
Yours?
Die Hard 3, when he realizes that he's not after revenge, he's after the money.
It's just like a Gruber.
Just like a Gruber. Oh, typical
Isn't
Gruber.
It always like
always
a Gruber.
Always like a Gruber. And then the very, very slow dawning realisation in 7 of what's in the box.
So that's one of those new light bulbs, that the energy saving ones.
It's an energy saving light bulb.
You turn it on and you're like, "Have I actually turned this light on?" And suddenly, slowly, the light builds in the room.
It's a really unpleasant grey tinged sort of a light, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's good when it gets there. I mean, not
for him.
It's bad.
Not for her, especially not for her.
No, definitely not for her.
There's tons of this stuff, because this is one of the great ways of revealing twists in a movie. So earplugs on if you don't want to know. But Ankit mentioned Usual Suspects. I don't know that there's a better one than that. I really don't. I mean, I enjoyed your answer, Johnny, and I admire your dedication to the National Treasure franchise. You're more dedicated than arguably John Turtletaub and Nicolas Cage are, because they haven't made the third one.
That's
Shirkers,
true.
Slackers.
If it was up to Johnny, look, he'd be making it right now.
We'd be on 5 by now.
in your house, do you have the two together on your bookcase, on your DVD collection?
Yeah.
And if you pull them, do they activate a secret
door? Yeah, door, yeah, which is where I keep my copy of the Declaration of Independence, the real copy of the Declaration of Independence.
That'd be amazing. Because Sean Bean's still on the table. The original movie. And I realise we may be digressing here, but just a little bit. This is my light bulb moment. Sean Bean lives in our film.
He's taken away by the police, isn't he?
Early Sean Bean lives moments, you know, because he dies in everything. Yeah, I think he even dies at the end of When Saturday Comes, when the ball rebounds at the crossbar and hits him in the head, and his head falls off. I think that's what happens in that movie. But he lives, so his character, Ian.
He's just in jail, yeah.
Ian.
Which is, I think, is one of.
That's amazing. Now we've remembered three character names.
If there is a fault with the National Treasure films, and I say if, it's that Ian is a terrible name for a villain.
It's a terrible name for a villain, yeah. Absolutely. It's awful.
Oh, I don't know. We've had Ian Freer and Ian Nathan in this office.
They're both very, very likeable people.
I know. Well, of course. But I'm just saying, it seems disrespectful to say that they couldn't, you know, be villains if they wanted to.
I don't think they can. I think the very name Ian precludes you from being a bad guy. All right, I'm going to say two. These are my choices. They're not definitive by any stretch of imagination, and I know that we're leaving tons out. Oh, by the way, I read one today because I was doing a little bit of reading around about this, and one did pop back into my mind, which is the end of Ace Ventura: Pet Detective, which has a reveal. If I don't know if you recall this reveal, but it's the sort of thing that they would not be able to get away with nowadays. If you recall the end of Ace Ventura: Pet Detective, at the very, very end, he has a revelation about the true nature of Sean Young's bad guy.
Right.
And he then, because it turns out that Sean Young is actually a guy, and he's horrified by that, and then spends 2 minutes, like, washing his mouth out with bleach and stuff. And yeah. So that popped back into my head. That's a weird one. And they wouldn't be able to get away with that these days.
One would hope not.
Yeah. And it was just a few years ago as well. How weird. The Sixth Sense is a good one. When Bruce Willis realises that he's a twist. And then Rollo Tomasi.
That is a great one.
Because that works in two levels, because there's a light bulb moment for Jack Vincennes, again Kevin Spacey, when he's shot in the heart, and that's like, oh, I've been shot in the heart. Hey, you're the bad guy, kind of thing. Oh, what? Oh, now I'm dead. But the real light bulb moment in that, it belongs to Guy Pearce, when James Cromwell says the name Rollo Tomasi to him to try and get a lead on it, and that reveals to Guy Pearce's character, Ed Exley, that James Cromwell is actually the bad guy.
Should we say LA Confidential at this point, in case no one knows?
Did I not say LA Confidential?
LA Confidential.
Hosting podcasts since 2012, I know exactly what I'm doing, people. Yes, LA Confidential, that's one of my favourites. So there we
go. Just in case you weren't sure what film was being spoiled for you. It was LA Confidential.
I mean, not just spoiled, but comprehensively spoiled. Next week, we'll spoil another movie. Sooner or later, we'll get to something you do care about. Right. Should we move on?
Yes.
If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast and dealt with by a bunch of bumbling idiots, then do email to us at podcast@empireonline.com. We're also on the Twitter machine as @EmpireMagazine. Use the hashtag Empire podcast. And we're on Facebook, Empire Magazine. And we do have a bunch of Facebook questions, which is good. So I'll get to those in due course. Okay. Time now for our first guest, who this week is one of our favourite actors. In fact, he's one of our favourite actors every week. He burst onto the big screen with various collaborations with Danny Boyle, including, of course, Shallow Grave, Train Spotting, and A Life Less Ordinary. He became a Jedi Knight along the way. He rode a bike around a bit, and he's been in approximately 627 movies in the past month, including this week's John le Carré adaptation, Our Kind of Traitor. He's our kind of Ewan McGregor, if you will, and Phil was chatting to him. Enjoy.
Really thrilled to welcome Ewan McGregor to the Empire podcast.
Thank you.
Hello, sir. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
We're very pleased to have you on to talk about Our Kind of Traitor and other things.
Right.
I was wondering about this movie. It's a Le Carré. Mm-hmm. And it's coming at a time that sort of just follows on the footsteps of The Night Manager.
Yeah.
Tinker Tailor wasn't that long ago when it was made. Le Carré feels like a real sort of cinematic and television brand now, in a way. Do you agree with that?
I don't know. I don't. I haven't seen the Night Manager because it's not. I live in the States. This hasn't come out in the States yet. I think it's starting there this week, I think. But so I haven't seen it. I can't talk
it's
about
really
it,
good.
And it's a shame because I really like Tom. I worked with him on stage, and we did Othello together at the Donmar Warehouse here in London. And so I look forward to seeing it. But I'm not sure there's talk of like him coming back at Le Carré. And I feel like he's always been there, you know, right back as long as he's been writing novels. I think people have been adapting them for the screen because he lends himself to that because he's such a... His stories are very good and driving. And also he writes such great detail about characters.
Mm.
So I liked reading his book very much for this one. I read the script first. This is usually the way with me when I get offered a role. Often I haven't read the book beforehand, and so then the book becomes like filling in gaps or given you details about character that maybe aren't in the, you know, you don't have time to write about in the film script.
Yes.
But I liked it. I think it's a great novel, and it's nice, sort of contemporary. It's got an old-fashioned spy feel because it's about... It could be a bit of sort of Cold War, if you like, because it's British Secret Service and Russia. But instead of it being Cold War, it's the Russian Mafia and the British Secret Service. So
yes, I was going to say that. It reminded me a little bit, maybe, that it's partly set in Marrakesh, of Hitchcock's The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Oh, yeah.
Just a little smidge of that.
Yes.
That your character...
Yeah, and then also Hitchcock's North by Northwest, because it really is a story about a man... I mean, in that case, it was about a very glamorous, handsome businessman who finds himself sort of embroiled into some espionage. And in my case, it's a professor, you know, a teacher of poetics,
yes,
in a London college, who finds
it's
himself
true.
Sort of drawn into a situation between the British Secret Service and the Russian Mafia.
Oh, so Perry Makepeace. Badass name, by the way.
Peregrine Makepeace. I suppose Perry is a shortened form of Peregrine.
Yeah, Peregrine, to give him his full name. It's a sort of new Roger Thornhill, in a sense, in this film. Was it a relief to you to be in a movie in which another actor gets their junk out and it not be you?
Yes. I was very happy to let Stellan swing, you know, freely in the breeze. And I haven't been naked in something for a while, to be honest. That's probably because of my age now. People are less. They're sort of more reluctant to get me to get my kit off in movies than they used to be.
I was going to say, and this is going to sound like sycophancy of the worst kind, but when Danny Boyle was talking about doing the Trainspotting sequel, he always said down the years that he was waiting for the cast to get older looking.
Yeah,
but you kind of haven't really got a lot older looking.
No, I have. The sequel to the Trainspotting novel, the
yes.
novel Porno, is set maybe 10 years after the novel of Trainspotting.
Yeah, okay.
But I think the movie that we'll make this year in the summer is going to be, it's now, you know, it's like we're not going to be acting 10 years after Trainspotting. It'll be,
right.
It'll be 20 years, I guess. So
will Renton be on Twitter, for instance? Will he have a healthy Facebook profile?
Well, that's an interesting point. I don't know.
Do you think
maybe I should start one?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm sure they'll start one. Yeah, you probably should. Well, you're an active tweeter obviously. Trainspotting just feels like one of those films that's just been so in the zeitgeist. I remember when it came out, the poster everywhere.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack everywhere.
Yeah.
I think it still is to a certain extent. Have you had down the years just a number of times and you just keep getting confronted with Trainspotting-abilia, as it were?
Not really. I mean, there's other films that I've made where I'm confronted with their abilia more.
Which ones?
Well,
of course.
The three not obvious ones, I suppose.
Yeah.
Which are more in the sort of, I don't know, unbelievably sort of in the social zeitgeist all the time. I don't really know why that is, but it seems to be the case. But with Trainspotting, it's more infrequent, but somebody found me a video. It probably was a video when it first came out, with a lighter and I think it was a pack of Rizzlers.
Really?
And a pair of sunglasses. And so somebody found the... You wouldn't get away with that now, would you?
No.
Film promotion.
Yeah,
with a lighter and a pack of Rizzlers. But anyway, they found their lighter from that pack, I guess, and gave it to me. And it's a really cool old-fashioned lighter with Trainspotting written on it. And things like that are really cool. I like that.
That's cool. Well, there's raised the bar for the promotion for the sequel.
Yeah, free needles.
Yeah, well, times have changed to an extent. Aside from our kind of traitor, you're a busy man in the cinema at the moment. Because you've got Miles Ahead with Don
yes.
Cheadle, the Miles Davis, a kind of biopic.
Yeah,
and
which he directed and acted in
yeah,
brilliantly.
Yeah, right,
and actually,
good point, yes.
It happened before I shot American Pastoral, and I didn't know I was going to be directing American Pastoral when I worked with Don. But I did learn a lot from him, and I watched him like a hawk when he was... I'd never acted with somebody who was also directing before. So it was my first experience of that. And it's odd. To begin with, the first day or two, to get notes from your acting partner is sort of like, it's a big no-no in acting. You know, you don't ever tell the person you're acting with what to do, or at least you shouldn't. And I would never dream of doing so. And so it was sort of peculiar for me as an actor to be given note, you know, in the middle of a take, for the other actor to go, no, cut, no, do it, like, try it, doing it like this. You know,
you're like, piss off.
Like, fuck you, what the hell? But in actual fact, it becomes very normal. And within a couple of days, it's like second nature. And I found it to be quite more inclusive in actual fact, because there's no one coming from the outside world into the scene, but you're actually just discussing it together and then doing it again. It feels that for the actors that we've got more creative input, I think.
Right.
And it's like the actors are in charge. You know, we've taken over. It's quite good. It's quite funny.
You've also got Jane Got a Gun, which I wondered if, you know, you play Colin McCann. He's a cracking villain, I have to say. I haven't seen you in too many villain roles. Have you had anyone that's seen the film and come up to you and not realise you were in it? Because you are heavily disguised in this film.
I haven't met too many people who have seen it at all, to be honest.
I've seen it, and I didn't realise it was you for a good, like, 20 minutes.
Oh, really?
I'll be honest.
That's good. Well, I'm glad.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm glad about that. I loved it. I came in very late on that movie, and the making of that movie would be a movie in itself. It started and stopped.
Do you know the full backstory?
Three or four times. Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I don't know probably more than you do, but I know that the film started on its first day without a director, and they had to find a director, and then... I had to stop for other reasons 2 or 3 weeks into the shoot, and then they got to the point where they had cast other actors to play the role that I played, and one by one they couldn't do it for one reason or another, to the point where they ran out of scenes to shoot without this actor, so they stopped.
Right.
And I was just coming back for, I'd been shooting Son of a Gun, because I was in my gun phase period of my life. It was my blue period, my gun period. And I'd just got back from that, so I'd been away, and it was quite unusual because I was in Australia. I was away from my family and my kids for like 12 weeks. It was a long stretch away. And I literally got the call a day before I flew back home saying, help, can you come to Santa Fe and in New Mexico and save the movie and shoot this part? So I didn't have the heart to say no. And also, I wanted to work with Gavin O'Connor, and I love Natalie Portman, and I'm good friends with Joel Edgerton's brother, Nash Edgerton. So there were so many connections, and I was so thrilled to be asked, to be honest. To be in a Western and to play the bad guy in a Western is something I love to always have done. So I got home, squeezed my kids, and repacked my bag, and off I went again. So, but it wasn't for too long, and I'm happy to be in it, and I think it's a very fine film.
Yeah, they forgave you.
They did.
I have to wrap shortly, but I just, before I go, I know a lot of people are very excited about Beauty and the Beast, a live action fantasia of a film that people are really, really fond of. Two films, in fact, because you've got the Belle and la Bête as well, the old French version of the myth.
Right.
You play a character who is basically in charge of holding candles for a period of the movie. Mm-hmm. Did that require a lot of sort of preparation work at home?
Physical strength.
Yeah. How big are the candles?
I don't know what to give away about it, to be honest.
Can you tell me about the audition? Because I understand you had to sing, or at least members of the cast had to sing a song from The Lion King.
Oh, I didn't.
Did you not? What did you? Did you have to do any of the
audition, darling?
Yeah, of course not.
I just swanned in. No, I didn't have to audition. They asked me to play the role, and it's one of those things. It was great fun to do. I was surrounded by fantastic people: Cerean McKellen and Emma Thompson, Stanley Tucci. I mean, we had a great cast, and it was fun. But again, it's sort of a daunting role because so many people are familiar and fond of the original, the animation.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then there's a temptation, I feel, not with Bill Condon, who's the director and a very fine director, but from maybe musically speaking, some of the other people involved, to recreate what he did. And I was thinking, well, I can't do that. I can't recreate what someone else did. I want to make it my own. So we're still in that process. We haven't finished. We still are due to do some more recording with the dialogue and the song. I found the accent hard. I've lived with a French woman for over 20 years, and I found the French accent really difficult to do.
Yeah,
I thought it would just come naturally, but it sounded definitely more Mexican than French. So we're still working on that. I don't want to do a Mexican Lumiere, for any other reason than he's meant to be in France.
You may have to record a Mexican version, though, so you'll be ahead of the curve.
Oh, right, exactly.
Maybe who knows?
Use that. Yeah,
who knows?
Right.
Last question. I just want to squeeze one Trainspotting sequel snippet from you that no one else knows. Can you tell me, for instance, Renton's first line of dialogue or first word in the script?
No.
Can you tell me if the word... Do you know the title at this point? Do you know it?
I think they're going to call it T2.
Right. Does the word Trainspotting have to be in the title, do you feel?
No, I don't think so.
Porno?
I don't think it's going to be called Porno. It's very loosely based on the novel Porno, which was the sequel novel to the Trainspotting novel, but quite loosely, I have to say.
Perfect. Well, we're looking forward to T2.
I didn't answer T2. Any of your questions, really.
Well, no, but I can understand why not. Can you tell me when you start shooting?
The summertime. We're shooting this summer in Scotland.
Love yourself. We're looking forward to that. Ewan McGregor, thank you so much for joining
us.
Cheers. Much appreciated.
Thanks, mate.
Okay, time now to talk about movie news. So, because we're talking about trailers now in the podcast.
Sure.
Thanks to the reader who pointed out that not talking about them was silly. Let's talk about the Assassin's Creed trailer, which hit the interwebs today, the time of recording. Johnny's a huge fan of the video game franchise. Is that fair to say, or do you just play it because you're addicted to video games?
I mean, neither of those things are strictly true, but I've certainly played a number of them, Okay. I have a couple of platinum trophies. Well,
I don't know what that means, but this is good because I have questions.
Go.
So he just happens to be on death row and he's the person who's the descendant of the person they need?
Next.
Right. So, in the games, is it sort of, are they always on death row? And that's how he just gets kidnapped in the games, doesn't he? He's like a normal bloke.
The first modern day protagonist does get, I believe, kidnapped, yes.
Right.
And he's stuck in a room, you don't really know why. So, certainly for the whole first game, you don't know why he's there. And he just goes back in time to the Holy Lands, Crusade time.
Okay.
And then the next games are set.
Is Florence? Is that Florence at some point?
It's Italian Renaissance,
sure.
Yes.
Okay.
And then there's American
War of Independence.
War of Independence. I was going to say Civil War, but it's Independence. And then so on and so forth.
Okay. This is interesting.
Nothing in Spain, really. I think they go to Spain in. We were talking and reminiscing about it yesterday Assassin's Creed Brotherhood.
We think
there might be a mission in Spain.
Right.
But I can't say for definite.
But this one is set very much in Spain, isn't
it? Yes, it does seem to be.
Yeah, he's a completely new character in a completely new time period for the franchise.
Mm. So, I mean, do we know... They haven't confirmed the time period beyond what we see on screen,
Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah, but that lasted 400 years.
15th century.
Well, no, it lasted from 1480 until the 1800s.
The film is 15th century.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. I think it's about 10 past four.
Thank you. Thank you. This is helpful.
Judging from the way the sun was hanging in the sky.
Yeah, because the Inquisition arrived in Seville in 1482.
Obviously.
So I was wondering, like, is it them arriving or what? But that would be interesting, because if it's 1482, then they haven't actually unified Spain yet. There's still a war going on against the Moors in Granada. So that's kind of an interesting, potentially, time if they actually use a bit of history in there.
Well, I have to say I was intrigued when I saw the trailer and that line came up, because nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Which is famously not true, is it?
You just turned around and looked at the door, Chris. Yeah.
Helen, you'll know this.
Yes, maybe.
It's not true. The Inquisition always gave, 30 days' notice.
Yeah, this is interesting. Actually, I mean, just to digress for a minute, the Spanish Inquisition wasn't that bad. They killed far fewer people than burned in the English witch trials.
They used a comfy chair?
They used the comfy chair. They didn't use the comfy
chair.
Their
chief weapons were fear and surprise. their two chief weapons were fear and surprise.
And a nice red uniform.
And a ruthless efficiency.
No, but genuinely, there's a theory in historian circles that their effect and their violence was blown out of all proportion by people who hated the Spanish crown, basically during the sort of 1800s. So they, you know, they made there's the sort of the black legend of Spain. So they made Spain sound more savage and more backward and more violent than it actually is, and that the Spanish Inquisition wasn't maybe quite as terrible as it's portrayed. So I suspect they're going to ignore that in this film, and they're going to go for
that would make sense to
the
me,
worst,
to ignore
yeah,
it.
Yeah. But the worst not, bits of the Inquisition.
But there was a little bit of inquisitizing.
Oh,
there was
some inquisitizing, and they did kill 3,000 people during the 300 years. They
so
were
not that bad then.
But that's during 300 years, so it's not that bad. Compared to the rest
it's
of Europe.
It's just 1,000 every century.
Yeah.
Also, how do we know those records were accurate back in the time? Because they didn't have pen and paper.
Because they were ruthlessly efficient, Chris.
That's true.
But no, it's honestly, it is an interesting setting because you've got a clash of sort of civilizations in Seville at that time. You see him jumping off the Giralda, which is now the bell tower of Seville Cathedral, which was very recently finished at the time. In fact, I think it wasn't even finished, if it is in the 1480s.
And how do you know so much about this stuff?
I tour guide there. And that's cool. That was built by Muslims. It was originally a tower to call the faithful to prayer. So it's cool.
Are you excited about the trailer? Do you think it looks good?
It's really... I feel like this whole thing is overcomplicated. I would have lost the modern day framework personally, but maybe there's a really great reason to keep it. I don't know.
In the trailer, though, that looks like the only bit with any semblance of a plot in it. It looks like the only interesting bit, which is odd because in the games you're like, ugh, ditch the modern day stuff. Mm. No one cares. Let's just play in, you know, Italy, Spain, wherever, sure, 400 years ago. But I don't know. Like in the trailer, it is a trailer, so there's no real plot in it anyway. But like, just feels that the oldie-timey stuff, I don't know why I said oldie-timey, but I did, that felt entirely action-focused and like plot-light, whereas it seems that there's interesting things that are going on in the modern day.
It does, and certainly if they've got Cotillard and Jeremy Irons in the modern day stuff, then that would suggest that the sort of the acting heavy lifting is going to be there. So I was wondering, like, is it going to be one of these things where he's been framed to get him into that position, and there's going to be a thing where he has to fight his way free or something in the modern bit.
In the games, you don't want to be with Abstergo. They are the bad guys.
Bad guys.
They are the,
okay,
Templars.
She does, yeah.
Okay.
And Marianne Cotillard does look a bit evil in this
one. She does look evil.
She looks, yeah, I wouldn't.
And Jeremy Irons doesn't look cuddly, I think it's fair to say.
You
would cuddle him.
I wouldn't cuddle him. I'd give him a firm, manly handshake.
Okay. Yeah,
he wouldn't like that.
Yeah. No, he wouldn't. But I thought the trailer looked pretty good, I have to say. Justin Kurzel, the director, looks to be bringing his own style to it as well. So, fingers crossed. And I know that Fassbender was doing a lot of training for the movie.
I still think we're hoping that this will be the video game adaptation that's actually good, right? I mean,
are we still hoping that Warcraft might be that?
Oh, that's true, we are. So we're hoping this will be number 2.
Yeah.
Right, okay, fine.
But not number 2 in the bad sense.
Not in the toilet sense. No.
Okay. All right. But yeah, there we go. So that's the trailer for Assassin's Creed. Nicely discussed. And once again, I wasn't expecting a kind of Spanish Inquisition. No, still haven't come in.
Monty Python still has not walked in the door, Chris. Who would have thought it? My goodness.
Honestly, if I were Michael Palin and I saw the trailer, my eyes would light up and I would get into my Spanish Inquisition costume because he'd still fit into it. And I would roam London just hoping that people would be discussing the Assassin's Creed trailer.
Wow.
And then I would burst in.
Yeah, saying that nobody expected.
Yeah.
I mean, now I'm really disappointed that he has better things to do with his time. My goodness.
Fair enough. Right, what should we talk about? What else is there to talk about? There must be some other things other than the Assassin's Creed trailer. How about Jack Black?
Jack Black, yeah, he's
joining Jumanji.
He's signed up for Jumanji opposite Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart.
Mm-hmm.
A little Hart and a big Johnson.
So tell me who he is in Jumanji based on the original film.
Well, we don't know yet.
Is he, which, because I feel they could all play Robin Williams' character, but then I also feel there are no other characters for them to play.
I feel like he could be, I think Jack Black could make a good fist of being the sort of the hunter dude. Do you remember the...
Yeah.
I think he'd be that.
The bad guy. Okay.
Well, I had a crazy thought about this today.
Okay.
And my crazy thought is that Dwayne the Johnson Rock...
Yeah.
Tweeted or Instagram something. He said, "Oh, delighted to be joined by Jack Emiven Black because he's a rock and
sure,
you know he can't bring himself to swear on social media." So he said, "Mmm, fun rather than motherfucking."
Mm-hmm.
Jack Black is joining Jumanji. It'll be the performance of a lifetime, So that indicates to me that either he is A, going to be the Robin Williams character, the guy who's trapped in the game and comes out, having lived his life within the game.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, and this is where the conspiracy theory, this is where Benjamin Franklin Gates might come in.
Mm-hmm.
He's playing R.L. Stein. And it's a Goosebumps Jumanji crossover. Because
would watch.
Because Goosebumps.
Yeah.
Same studio.
Yeah. Same kind of age range.
Same age range. And let's be honest, same plot.
You're right.
So. Why? What? There's no reason it's nonsense, obviously, and a mad conspiracy theory, but that's my conspiracy theory. I'm putting it out there that this is not just Jumanji, but it's also Goosebumps 2.
Jumanji versus Goosebumps.
Because we know that Sony, they're combining Men in Black and Jump Street into one movie, so why not combine Jumanji and Goosebumps into one movie as well?
Do you know what? That is the best crazy, ridiculous conspiracy theory that you have ever come up with.
There's more. And then the sequels to those two are then combined into one movie. So Men in Black meets Jump Street meets Jumanji meets Goosebumps. And they've got Spider-Man back.
I'm all for it. I'm all for it. And if we can get the National Treasure series in there somehow, I know it's Disney, but come on.
I think we
can make it work.
If Disney have loaned Iron Man to Spider-Man, they can loan Ben Gates.
Well, the thing you have to wonder about a third National Treasure movie is what treasure is there for them still to seek, right? They've got the treasure from the Templars in the first one.
Yeah.
And the second one was...
Lost City of Gold.
Lost City of Gold. Okay. So where is there a massive mythical hoard of treasure?
There are seven Lost Cities of Gold.
Okay. Oh, my God. So you're seeing an... Like, release that many more?
Well, I just remember that from the TV show, The Mysterious Cities of Gold. There was one in that, they found one, and then they did a sequel about 2 years ago, which is to find the second one, which I didn't see, so spoilers. And then, you know, potentially there could be five more of those TV shows.
I would love to see National Treasure 3 take place in the BBC archives. And
they find the missing Doctor Who's.
Missing Doctor Who's, missing Dad's Army. That's great stuff.
Yeah, that's, I think, the National Treasure we all want
to see. The missing Pete and Dud episodes.
God. Oh.
Not only, but also...
No, but it was just when you said, when you pointed out that National Treasure was owned by Disney. I'm thinking my way through other Disney properties that they could cross over with. And I was thinking, like, hey, just a crazy idea here. Something like Wakanda. They could cross over. Oh. We know Black Panther's got a heck of a lot of money.
Where's it coming from?
Where is it coming from?
Follow the money.
Follow.
Which then that crosses over with All the President's Men. So Woodward and Bernstein investigate. But hang on.
What?
Woodward is...
Oh no!
Woodward's Robert Redford. Who, as we all know, is Alexander Pierce, the head of Hydra. Oh my God!
We've blown this thing.
Does that mean Nixon was a good guy? I'm really confused. Should we talk about something else? Oh my God. I've really got the deep throat this. Big time. I've got to go home tonight and do some serious deep throating. Just to... What?
Nothing.
Are you okay?
I just have a
don't say it. You got something in your throat. All right. Okay. I said don't say it, and then I immediately said it.
Don't say it because I want to.
Yeah, essentially. I apologise profusely to someone. All right, okay, what else? What else is there?
Well, should we talk about... there's some sort of film festival going on in France. Is that a new thing?
Yes, I've never heard of it before. Cannes Film Festival. Well, have you all been? John, have you been?
I've never been.
You've never
been to France? We used to have summers on the Dordogne. But no, I've not been to the film festival.
Oh man, you're missing a lot of walking.
You are actually
a lot of walking.
Okay. I went last year for the first time. I was there for a princely 3 days. Saw one film, which was terrible.
What was it?
It was called Sea of Trees. It hasn't even been released here.
Sea of Trees?
Yeah, Matthew McConaughey and Naomi Watts.
And Ken Watanabe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not good. And there's a lot of Eurotrash. You know the way, like, you remember Eurotrash used to be on TV back in the day, and there'd be all these incredibly tanned people with, you know, incredibly false bits.
Yes, I remember that.
They actually
loved
exist,
that.
And they come out and they parade every night in Cannes.
Okay.
And you can sort of see these strange-looking individuals go past.
Okay. It sounds great.
It's fascinating.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll never go through childbirth, obviously. But for me, the Cannes Film Festival's a bit like the equivalent of that for me, because it's quite hellish when you're doing it, and then you leave it behind and you go, oh, well, I quite enjoyed that. Oh, that'd be good. Oh, I'd like to go back. But, you know, as always next year. Always next year. But we have Damon Wise out there at the moment who's doing stuff for us. So
yeah, but there hasn't been much news yet out of Cannes. The new Woody Allen is apparently not bad. I've seen...
Heard not bad.
Yeah, I've heard, you know, slightly warmer
than
that.
From Damon Wise, in fact.
Yeah, I've heard slightly warmer reviews than that and then slightly colder reviews, but the consensus is in the not bad range.
Which is what generally happens when a Woody Allen film comes out.
And then there was a very strange film this morning called Staying Vertical. And all I've seen so far is tweets, not full reviews. But that sounds like this year's Love 3D, if you remember the Gaspar Noé film from last year.
Remember
except
it.
Even more
Boy,
explicit.
Do I love that movie.
Really?
I got through about 10 minutes and decided it wasn't for me.
Yeah, I saw it on the big screen in 3D and it was not for me either, if I'm honest.
I lasted about 10 minutes as well.
Too easy. Let's move on.
So Michael Shannon has joined Guillermo del Toro's new movie. So Guillermo is linked to, he's attached to Fantastic Voyage, but he's not making that first. He's making one of his smaller movies next. It's called The Shape of Water, and we know it's going to be set against the backdrop of the Cold War. It's going to be a kind of a love story with maybe a magical element to it as well. Good cast. Sally Hawkins, we love Sally Hawkins. Mm. Octavia Spencer, we love Octavia Spencer.
Brilliant.
Richard Jenkins, we love Richard Jenkins.
Oh, amazing.
Now Michael Shannon has joined the cast as well, so it's all very, very exciting. So fingers crossed for that one.
That sounds great.
But to join that cast, he's left another cast. He's mm-hmm. left Steven Soderbergh's NASCAR heist movie.
Well, that's because Soderbergh is retired, so that must be some kind of hallucination on everyone's part.
No, but Kylo Ren is signed up instead now to replace him. His real name is Adam Driver, of course.
Of course.
Did they just want a driver and then he answered the call?
I don't.
Because it's a NASCAR film.
What?
See what it,
no, what?
Follow the money.
I read about Adam Driver and something else today. There is a rumour that he will be involved in Terry Gilliam's long, 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 long awaited.
You missed
the
out man- on the
long. Sorry, I apologise.
Do it
long,
again.
Long, 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 long awaited.
Now you're singing in a circle.
The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. Which should be exciting.
I will believe it when I see it.
I just, come on. I mean, there has never been a project that has had more blood, sweat and tears put into it.
You have not seen Paul Blart Mall Cop 2 in that case.
I have not, and I'm okay with that. Mm. This needs to happen, and if Adam Driver can help it happen, then Godspeed to all concerned. But I would really, really hope that that happens, because it's been decades. It needs to be off Terry Gilliam's plate. And onto our screens.
Yes, indeedly, Beedly. Right. And yes, I did just say indeedly, Beedly. So there's three things that broke last week in time-honoured tradition, just as our podcast went up. Number one, Michael Cicchino to score Marvel's Doctor Strange. I approve of this.
I am okay with this.
I think he is the best composer in Hollywood right now. And if I could choose one composer to go back and rescore all the Marvel movies so that all the themes progress from film to film like Star Wars, it would be Cicchino for me. So that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But there are two big stories that broke on Friday. So I'll give you an option of which one to discuss first. Tom Hooper directing Cats.
Ugh.
Or Alden Ehrenreich, apparently 100% confirmed as Han Solo. Although I still don't think there's an official announcement yet.
Can we do Cats first, just to get it out of the way?
Let's do Cats, get out of the way.
I mean, you did it when you went, ugh.
Well, no, I mean, I don't mean that against Tom Hooper. I mean that against Cats.
Oh,
I saw that musical when it came back to London recently, because I'm like, oh, this is a big famous musical that people talk about.
It's diabolical.
I should go see it. It's so unbelievably terrible.
Why is it terrible?
Utterly awful. The music isn't great, apart from that one song that you know.
I don't know.
Memories.
No, wait, that's the other one.
No, no, no,
oh, yeah, that's the other one. I was thinking the Barbra Streisand one. So there's...
Okay,
that one.
Also, they're all cats. It's stupid. I don't care. I hated it.
I mean, lots of films have cats in it. The Jungle Book has cats in it.
I mean, yeah, but those cats are good. These cats are terrible.
I took my wife to see it because it came back to the West End and Nicole Scherzinger from the Pussycat Dolls was in it.
It was the same production I saw.
Yeah. And it was billed as...
She sang very well. Yeah.
It was billed as, come and see Nicole Scherzinger. Nicole Scherzinger! In Cats. Starring in Cats. It's Griselda? Griselda?
Griselda.
Griselda. And you go, oh, that's...
Or Grisella.
Yes, let's watch that. And then she's on stage for about 8 minutes. She has the one good song. Most of it involves her standing at the back, licking her paws and looking a bit sad. And then she has the one good song towards the end. And then she does a reprise of it towards the end as well. And then that's it. And you're kind of going, oh, well, okay. But as long as the rest of it is good, then that's fine. But it's not. It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible.
we're going to get the musical theatre people coming after us for saying this. So,
so quickly mention Hamilton, just yeah. So they can. You know,
I'm literally drinking out of a Hamilton mug right now. Look. That was a Hamilton water bottle. So I just, but it's not, I don't understand. It's one of these things we talked about at the time, Chris, where you come out going, how is this a huge phenomenon that everyone has gone to see over 30 years? How, what do people see in it that we're not seeing? I genuinely don't understand. Tom Hooper, what, why? I don't understand.
But what do people say about it?
I don't know. I don't understand where they're coming from. That's the
fundamental problem. Because this is the moment to immediately hit the internet and like go to whatever the Rotten Tomatoes of the West End is and like read the reviews, right?
Oh, they're all just, but they all just seem to think it's great that, you know, these cats like jump around a bit and then, you know,
Jellicle cats. Jellicle cats.
Oh, I feel similar about Phantom of the Opera.
Phantom
like
of the Opera.
I love that.
Yeah, that's great.
That bit's great.
Yeah.
I like that one.
No, but well, it has like at least two good songs, if not three.
So the rest of the show's boring.
Yeah, but it has a plot and a character
no
that goes through the middle. No. Genuinely, there's not a plot.
Blow.
I probably the best seats I ever had for a theatre production as well. We were like second row. It was great. The actors came into the audience, not like that. It wasn't like the Deuce Bigelow European Gigolo situation. It was, but they walked among us in their silly little cat costumes, and you know, at times because you could see the actor's eyes, you were really close, and you could see just like, oh, what am I doing? why I made this choice? Awful.
Anyway,
awful.
So yeah, so but, I mean, he's doing it, and I'm sure it'll be huge.
But we look forward to the
Oscars, and I'm fascinated to know how it is done, but I don't get it right
now. And you could do a lot worse than cast Nicole Scherzinger.
You could
as Nicole Scherzinger.
Thanks, Chris.
Nicole Scherzinger as
Grisella.
Yes, sir. Oh, and I remember now when I bought my because I bought the tickets for my wife for as a Christmas present, and I put like lots of different photographs of people into different envelopes as a bit of a clue. So there was a picture of Nicole Kidman, and then there was a picture of Cher, and then there was a picture of Bryan Singer.
Amazing.
And then there was
Chris.
A picture of a cat. She still didn't put it together.
That is strange. Imagine not putting those things together.
What's going on? All right, so the other one is Alden Ehrenreich, cast as young Han Solo. Is this definitely 100% official? Because this was a deadline said in the States that this is happening. It's happened. He's won out and he has been cast as young Han Solo. I still haven't seen an official release from Lucasfilm. I won't believe this until at least 3 years after the film comes out with him in it. But it looks like he has beaten Jack Rayner and Taron Egerton into the role.
Well, I mean, he was a bit of a favourite of ours in Hail Caesar. We do love him. I think he's probably the one who looks most like Harrison Ford out of those three, albeit he's also probably the shortest.
Aren't you a little short to be a Han Solo?
I mean, that seems cruel now we say it out loud. But anyway, but you know, I think he could be good. I'm still not 100% clear why we're having a young Han Solo film, but I am assured by Lawrence Kasdan on this very podcast when he talked to us about Star Wars that there is something there worth telling and that it won't just be a how I got my Chewie. You know, so happy days.
I thought I'd happily watch that. How I Met My Chewie. That'd be amazing. Johnny, what are your thoughts on this?
He seems fine. I really liked him in Hail Caesar. I wanted Taron.
Yeah,
I like Taron. I really liked him as Eddie the Eagle.
He was charming. He was really charming in that.
And so I've seen Taron in more things and know he could probably do it. Whereas I've seen this guy whose name I
Alden
can't pronounce.
Yeah,
and well, I've seen him do one thing and he did it really well, but yeah. It wasn't that much of a stretch.
He had a tiny role in Blue Jasmine, which people might have seen as well.
Beautiful Creatures.
He was in Beautiful Creatures. We talked to him for that. Many, many years ago now, it feels like.
On the pod. Hey, amazing. So you can go back and listen to that episode if you want to hear the man who would be the future Han Solo.
I think the basic thing is, though, you see it and you're not like, oh, God. You're like, great.
Yeah, that's the good news. Mm. So,
yeah, there are actors out there who were linked with the role that had they been cast, I would have hurled everything out the window. Anyway, so it looks like Alden Ehrenreich is Han Solo. My skepticism toward this movie has been well documented, but I love Phil Lord, I love Chris Miller, I love Han Solo, I love Star Wars, I love Alden Ehrenreich. I suspect they'll make a great movie. Would that it were so simple.
See? Trippingly, dear boy. Trippingly.
Subtle references. Okay, that's it for movie news, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay, we're done. Okay, so on to our second guest now. I said earlier on that I would do this link later. And I wasn't kidding, because our next guest is the director of Slacker, Dazed and Confused, School of Rock, Waking Life, Scanner Darkly, Boyhood, tons of other movies. And now, of course,
the Before Trilogy.
The Before Trilogy. How did I forget that lot? Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Before Midnight. That's it. Okay, not in the right order, but there you go. And now he's the director of Everybody Wants Some! ! A spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused. We sent John Nugent along to him. It is, of course, Richard Linklater. Linklater! Linklater! That's what I was doing! Okay, there we go. Enjoy.
Richard Linklater, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
Doing great, how are you?
Yeah, very well.
All right.
We are obviously here to talk about Everybody Wants Some.
Yes. Two exclamation points.
Well, this joins like the pantheon of exclamation points movies, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got like Airplane and Three Amigos.
Yeah.
Safety Last.
I think the first, who did it first? Like the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical Oklahoma.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It had an exclamation point after it back in 43. So yeah. That might have been the first exclamation point.
Yeah, so this, I guess you could call it a sort of coming-of-age movie, a college movie.
Mm-hmm.
I've personally never played baseball. I've never been to Texas, but I felt, you know, sort of weirdly nostalgic watching this film.
Good. Cinema's powerful that way. It can make you, transport you to a place in time that you kind of make it look fun or at least interesting, you know, culturally, or, you know, it's a powerful medium that way.
Yeah.
I didn't really set out to make a nostalgic film I'm not a particularly nostalgic person at all. There's no point in my life I'd like to go back and relive but, you know, I'm usually making films that I'm trying to figure out what I think about a certain subject or something. But I think this is the first one where I kind of landed on, oh, yeah, that was a pretty good time to
yeah.
me. You know, maybe it was, you know, my adult life starting there. I go, oh, that was good. You know, that was a good time to be in college, culturally and just socially, everything about that moment. It was kind of pre-Reagan era, Reagan-Bush era. Pre-AIDS, you know, there were a lot of pre's in the world. So to me, looking back, it seemed like kind of a transitional moment. It never feels that way when you're in it. You just think this is the world, you know. And I think a lot of young people see this movie and, you know, you always have to be excited about your moment, you know, with the music you like and everything going on around you. But there's certain elements you look at this and go, oh, that was pretty fun. People don't really dance that way anymore. It was much more social and communal. You know, if you got five people in a car back then, you know, you might sing along to a song or, you know, have some fun. Now, I think you'd have everybody with their head in their lap, you know, texting somebody or checking something.
Yeah.
You know, it's like everybody's kind of technology kind of isolates. It connects on one level, but it kind of isolates on another. So
Everybody Wants Some, if it was set in 2016, would just be via Twitter or...
I don't know. Not really. I could have set this in a contemporary setting and it would still be the same story.
Yeah.
It would just be a little different.
So what is interesting about this film is it deals with the jocks. It deals with the alpha males, I guess. the sort of bro culture has got a bit of a bad rap in recent years. But
yeah.
This sort of celebrates that
yeah.
subset, I guess.
I think I was looking back like that was it for me. Like I look back at my life and that was the end of the testosterone bro culture in my life. So I was going like it's kind of a short-lived thing and people see it as kind of a dangerous thing. You know, you get a pack of young men together, they can do bad things, but I don't remember any of that. We didn't do that. We were like, it was just a fun group of people who, you know, were very competitive because we played sports, but there weren't guys who were, you know, it's really the gamut of personalities, but it didn't have a dark side. And I think, well, why should it? You know, these guys are at the top of the food chain.
They, yeah.
You know, sports, the way the public kind of elevates sports to, I think, an unhealthy way. But if you're an athlete and you find yourself in it, you can't blame them for being like kind of going along for the ride, you know?
Yeah, I liked how all the characters were sort of pretty much devoid of prejudice. I mean, they took on these other subcultures like punk and and disco and even country and western, and they just sort of embraced it.
Yeah.
And I thought that's something you don't often see in films. It tends to be more sort of rigidly stereotyped.
Yeah, I think the world wants to break you down and put you in a group, and I think people do that just the way they might see this group of guys. Oh, they're athletes. They must be, you know, a bunch of bad guys that we don't like or something. But familiarity, you know, if you get to know people, you see that. But I think that was just being that age. You know, the walls come down probably a little older you get. I run into old friends. When did you become such a, you know, reactionary redneck? Because you were like a cool young person. What happened? You know, if you listen to the wrong radio and watch the wrong TV, the world gets a little more. You find out you're an angry person about stuff. But youth is about being open, you know, ideally open to experience, open to new ideas. Yeah. You should be curious and not think you have the answers, and be open to finding out more about yourself, you know.
This film obviously has a massive ensemble cast. Yeah. Am I right in thinking you guys all got together for a few weeks beforehand and just sort of hung out?
Yeah, that's the methodology. Yeah. I always want to get that rehearsal time just so we can, you know, kind of get each other's rhythms. You know, I'm trying to just make the best movie I can. And the way I can maybe do that is getting to know my cast and fine-tuning the script around them. And building on the ideas that are in the script. I'm never too precious about it. It's not like theater, you know, you're not a great playwright or something, or it's not a piece of literature. A film script is just the beginning to make the movie that I want to make. So I'm really trying to dial in those characters and have a kind of a melding of the character on the page with the actor I've cast.
So what was that rehearsal process like? Because you were living together, right? You're sort of living on each other's
fun. Buckets. I have some land outside of Austin and a big bunkhouse.
Oh, nice.
You know, like my daughter has like her whole class over, you know, so it can sleep like
12.
Well, they're kind of double beds, so technically it could probably sleep a lot more. But
so it's
each
like
guy
like
had
a dormitory.
Their own. Yeah, it's like, you know, like 12 guys were able to live in this one area.
Wow.
And it was good. I knew they would bond. Like, that's really getting to know someone. We were working on this thing all the time. Even when I would leave them in the evening, I knew they were still working. In the same way, it would all be beneficial.
So there was no hijinks then? There was no, like, hazing behind the scenes?
No. It was kind of adults kind of looking back.
Too old for that sort of thing.
Yeah, but
This film is semi-autobiographical, is that right to say? So, I mean, how much are there elements that are drawn from real life? Are there characters that are based on real people?
I think the characters are these amalgams of guys I knew or the types of people. And it definitely feels like it grew out of that real life experience. Mm. Almost everything in the movie you could say happened on some level.
Okay.
It'd probably be easier to say what didn't exactly happen.
Okay.
You know, I wasn't taped to a fence, duct taped to a fence. That happened to a friend of mine at a school in Louisiana.
Was there ever a friend who would chat up women saying he had an average penis to sort of lower their expectations?
Not at that time. That was later in life.
Okay.
I had an actor friend who did that.
He actually did that. Did it work?
That's a pretty good... Yeah, it worked. I was like, that's brilliant. I'm going to use that someday. Yeah. And I thought Finnegan, you know, Glenn Powell's character, I thought, okay, he's the guy who can pull off that.
I mean, that's pretty audacious, isn't it?
Yeah.
An interesting tactic. You work on very interesting time frames. I mean, Boyhood was shot over 12 years. Everybody wants some set over a weekend. I mean,
a long weekend, yeah.
What's the next? Are you going to have your next film just set over an hour? Or
I want to set one in backwards time, like you actually lose time.
Yeah, like Memento or something.
Yeah, you go back in time.
Yeah.
I've done my animated film, Waking Life, is arguably, you don't know the time frame of that movie. It could be seconds. In a way, that's the weirdest of all. So that's kind of the oddest of them all. No one ever mentions.
Yeah, I did want to ask you about Waking Life, actually. That's, I was a film and philosophy student, so that was sort of
perfect.
my yeah. ideal movie. I watched it on repeat. Philosophy is a sort of thing, a thread that runs through all of your movies in a way. I mean, you've even got characters in this movie talking about Camus and the myth of Sisyphus. I mean, what is it that attracts you to that sort of material? And I mean, would you consider another sort of boldly philosophical movie again?
I have several that I'm working on that would fit into that category, I guess.
Yeah.
isn't it kind of just the way you process the world or where you think about life? So I guess that's just always been there. And I always thought it was kind of interesting, characters commenting on life or talking about it, that that in itself can be cinematic.
Yeah.
That's the big leap, that if you think cinema isn't a place for that. So I've always rebelled against that notion. Like, you know, cinema, you're not supposed to show people talking about things. You're supposed to show people doing things.
Yeah.
That's cinema 101. And I was always like, well, people talking about things is kind of doing things. You know, that's evocative in its own way. It depends. Is it compelling? Is it interesting? Is it funny? Who are they? Are you, do you find them interesting? You know, the characters. So I've always kind of never quite bought that notion. I was up for the challenge, trying to make it work.
Yeah. I think that's all the time we have. But Richard Linklater, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah. Well, great talking to you.
Great talking to you. Okay, so. Cheers.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. So that was Richard Linklater with John Nugent. And let's start off the movie reviews section with Everybody Wants Some! !
Does this mean we have to call it Dazed Ampersand Confused?
Quite possibly. Helen?
Yeah, this is very much like Dazed and Confused in that it's a sort of, not a day in the life, but several days in the life of a group of young men. Our sort of focus character, if you like, is Jake, who's played by Blake Jenner, who's pretty much a newcomer. And he's the freshman who turns up to college a few days before term starts because he's on the baseball team. I guess he's got a sort of baseball scholarship or however these things worked in 1980 America. And he moves into the baseball team house where they all live together. And it's basically a group of guys hanging out and partying before term starts. That is the plot.
That's the plot.
That is the entire plot of the movie. Spoiler, it's a bunch of guys who party. But it's just kind of, it's just really strangely charming. And I say this as someone who's not necessarily disposed to like a film about a bunch of essentially frat jocks trying to get off with as many women as possible in as short a time as possible. But there's a kind of an innocence to their massive enthusiasm for basically partying, and it's just very sweet. They're so young. I don't know. So really, really good cast. Most of them not that well known. I think for me, Glenn Powell as Finn was the standout. I think he's absolutely terrific in this. I think he's going to get a bit of a wind behind him coming out from this. He's the kind of charismatic ladies' man, but there is a little bit of another side to him that you begin to see, which I think just makes him really, really fascinating. You've got Wyatt Russell, who's been good in a few things recently, as Willoughby, who's the stoner dude, who's the kind of spiritual guru, I feel like,
sure,
at the house.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just a nice and very believable collection of, you know, average young men listening to good music, as you would expect from a Richard Linklater film, and, you know, partying in Texas.
Yeah, I thought it was just wonderful.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's so easy in a film with so many characters for some of them to get lost. But yeah. I felt like there were 12 main characters in this, and I felt that every single one of them I recognised as distinct. I knew who they were.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very, very difficult thing to do, and he's done it, you know, almost effortlessly.
Mm-hmm. And the airport fight is fantastic.
Really, really good.
The ping pong match, though. Absolutely
yeah,
terrific.
I mean, this is great, and Glenn Powell's character says something in it which you know, really rung true to me as a man who has been a younger man and has been to university and lived with other men. And he said, you know, we all take our turn at being chumps. We accept our chumpification and then we pass it on. And there is that. There is that. That, you know, no one is, you know, immune. No one is I'm the lead jock guy. And there's no, like, I'm his crazy sidekick. And it's all felt very, very real to me.
Yeah, that is true, actually, because I've forgotten his character name, but Tyler Hoechlin is the guy from Teen Wolf. He's actually also from the kid from Road to Perdition back in the day. He is afflicted with a terrible moustache in this film. And he's kind of, he would see himself, I think, as the lead jock. He would see himself as the...
Yeah.
As the main guy, and he's certainly intensely competitive. But he's the one in the ridiculous crop t-shirts. So he looks like, As was the style at the time.
I'm wearing one now.
But yes, Chris, and I've been meaning to ask you about that.
Should I put the trousers on?
Yeah, okay. If you could. But, you know, in the style of the time, it may have looked very cool, but to modernise, he looks, you know, like he's on his way out to a party of a different sort. And it, you know, it's just, it's a very interesting way to present him. I think it's great.
Yeah, we really love this movie.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And so we gave it one star. 4 stars for everybody wants some exclamation mark, exclamation mark. But yes, as you can see, Helen and Johnny absolutely adored it.
Yeah.
Good stuff indeed. Okay, up next is a movie that came out in the States in March. It is Tina Fey's A Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, directed by Glenn Ficarra and John Requa, starring Tina Fey, of course, and Martin Freeman and Margot Robbie. Johnny, what's this one like and what's it about?
Well, Tina Fey is works in TV but is going nowhere, so accepts a commission to go to live in Kabul and cover the war there, which she does. She meets Margot Robbie, who is another journalist out there, and Martin Freeman does the same thing. And they're living in what they call the Kabubble, which is, you know, this all these, I suppose, expats living together, partying hard and, you know, chasing down stories. And so it starts off kind of light and fuzzy, and she complains about, you know, there's been so much feces in the air when you get over there, and then it becomes slightly more serious as the, I suppose, as you know, the realities of the war hit home. I haven't really loved many of Tina Fey's movies, but really do like her on TV. Really like 30 Rock and think she's a wonderful comedian, and this feels like the most successful she's been on the big screen. And so it is funny. Her relationship with Martin Freeman's character and her relationship with Margot Robbie's character are both interesting. Mm. It's very difficult to balance the drama and the fact that you're at war with a comedy, and I think it actually does quite a good job of that.
Mm. It's based, of course, on the book The Taliban Shuffle by the journalist Kim Barker, and that's essentially who Tina Fey is playing in this.
Yeah.
It's you know, very, very closely adapted. But they changed the name, Taliban Shuffle. You can kind of see why. Whiskey Tiger Foxtrot.
I
think that's
name.
Much of a better name.
And it's a good
Do you
name.
Think it's a
good
yeah.
name. Yeah, WTF.
I know. I get the connotations, but
no. Do you understand it?
Yes.
So WTF, if you like, that's phonetics, and then you put the initial letters there, and it stands for something else.
But what the fuck does WTF mean?
Oh, we'll check later. Look, can you look it up online?
Another shout out. We're full of references today. Oh,
amazing.
God, it's like a film podcast or something. So this is 3 stars.
We gave it 3 stars, which is a recommendation.
3 stars for Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, which indeed is a recommendation, as Johnny says. Up next, Green Room.
Yeah, this is a new one from Jeremy Saulnier, who's presumably going to follow it with something involving the colour red, because this comes after Blue Ruin, so it would make sense.
Yeah.
This
I think yellow would make more sense.
It depends on whether you're going, like, in terms of paint or in terms of light.
I think if you're going in... That told me. Just stopped me dead in my tracks. Fine. As you were.
So it's it's a story set in Oregon. It's about a punk band called The
Origin.
Ain't Right. It's not an origin story, Chris. Oh, it's an Oregon story.
Okay. It's both.
It's an Oregon town.
The Ain't Right are a punk band. They are playing at a club which turns out to be full of neo-Nazis, basically. So, naturally, the band open with a cover of the Dead Kennedys' Nazi Punks Fuck Off, which is brilliant. But actually, they kind of seem to win everybody over during the gig. It goes okay. They get back to their green room, the dressing room, and discover a corpse and her friend. And essentially, it then becomes a siege movie. They take the bouncer hostage, the manager of the club and his boss, who is played by Patrick Stewart, outside, lead their own people to try and resolve the situation by any means necessary. And those means are rather gory. So if you are of a delicate disposition, this is not the movie for you this week. It is not. Do mm-hmm. not go and see it. People mm-hmm. have left the theatre.
It should be called Red Room, basically.
Yeah. People have left the theatre rather the worse for wear. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially a siege movie from that point on. It's kind of, you know, conversations and then bursts of action as things kind of go horrendously wrong. There are very tense negotiations. It does have some surprises. You won't see everything coming, I don't think, in this one, which I think is nice because, you know, sometimes in this kind of movie, you know exactly what's going to happen and to who and when.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't the case here. So we kind of love this. We gave this 4 stars as well. But again, just this 4 stars does come with the caveat that you have to be gore ready.
Yeah. I liked Blue Room, but I didn't love it. I thought it was a little too self-satisfied at times, but I liked the fact that it unfolded in very interesting ways, and this one does as well. You're absolutely right. You're not going to see everything coming, and we shouldn't talk about it too much in detail because it might give stuff away. But Patrick Stewart, very, very good. I
very
really, really like his sweater in this as well.
I mean, sure, that's definitely what leapt out from his performance.
It's what I take away from most films.
From most films, yeah. Is jumper advice.
Is your sweater action up to speed?
Sure.
And in this case, it is. So well done, Sir Patrick. And 4 stars, as you rightly say, for Green Room. Okay, also out this week is Our Kind of Traitor. Sadly, we're not going to get a lot of time to discuss it in depth, but it is a solid adaptation of John le Carré with good performances. 3 stars for that one, which is a recommendation. So do check it out if you like your spy movies. And also out this week, we talked earlier on about video games. Is Warcraft or Assassin's Creed going to be the first proper belter? And I was going to say, well, maybe the Angry Birds movie, which is out this week, might be the first proper belter. And then I realised we gave it 2 stars and it is not the first proper belter. So
no. John Nugent saw that and complained that the birds just weren't angry enough. Rarely angry, he said the birds
were. To be fair though,
John
Nugent,
but they were chirpy.
He's a very angry man though, and I'm not sure that much on-screen anger would really match his level. He goes into things just angry, looking to take it down and destroy people's careers. He's not happy if he hasn't destroyed at least 4 careers before breakfast.
Wow.
that's John Nugent. I mean, who's a perfectly lovely guy. And I don't know why I've painted him as this in the podcast, but there you go.
Is he going to edit this as well?
Does he edit this week's episode? Will he? Possibly, in which case he'll keep us in, John. Right, so that's it for this week's Emperor podcast. Join us next week for more film related fun. We'll be joined by Jack Rayner, who made it to the top 3 apparently for Han Solo, and John Carney, who didn't, the star and director of the excellent Sing Street. We'll be joined by them, so very, very good. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Johnny.
Goodbye.
Who's off now to watch both National Treasures, I presume.
Yeah, I've only seen them twice today already, so I'm behind my usual quota.
Got to write that Ben Gates fan fiction. And it's goodbye from me. And I'm off to have a light bulb moment. In fact, I just had one. I remember what is possibly my favourite light bulb moment across film and television. And it's the episode of Spaced where Simon Pegg goes, "Oh my God." And then he realises he's got some fucking Jaffa cakes in his pocket. That one. Mic drop. That was a pen. See you next week. Bye.